Oye, ¿cómo va? That's Carlos Santana with the great anthem of the ages. Oye, ¿cómo va? Meaning, hey, how's it going? What's up? This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, September the 25th, and we will be taking a look at two issues today. A legal battle is brewing in the city of New York as a parents' rights group seeks to overturn a decision by the Education Department to distribute morning-after contraceptive pills and other birth control drugs to students in selected schools. But first, our guest, Professor Luis DeCipio, gives us an overview of the Latino electorate and why predictions about its political preferences in the presidential election may be off the mark. Luis DeCipio is a political scientist and professor of Chicano and Latino studies at the University of California, Irvine. He has written extensively on Latino politics and on governmental policies having inordinate impact on Latinos. Thank you, Professor DeCipio, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, almost 20 years ago, when you wrote Counting on the Latino Vote, Latinos as a New Electorate. Clearly, you knew something back then, but today you speak of Latino electorates, plural. Why the plural?
Well, I think it's inaccurate to paint all Latinos with a single brush. The community includes people whose ancestry goes back to Mexican settlers in New Mexico in the 1600s and immigrants who arrived yesterday or last week. And although Latinos share some common public policy needs, they vote differently, they vote at different rates, they vote for different parties. They're very shaped by the context of their states and the degree to which people are asking them to participate in American politics.
So why is it that when, the African-American vote or electorate is regarded pretty much the same way as a monolith, why the insistence that it is a monolith and it has a predictable monolithic behavior?
Well, I think the historical experience of African-Americans in the United States shaped it. Connection to U.S. politics in such a way that it has come to vote largely with a single voice. You know, it's not unusual in a presidential election to have 90 or 95% of African Americans supporting the Democratic candidate in a national race. Now, clearly, even that isn't a monolith, though there was one poll a few weeks ago that showed statistically no support for Governor Romney in the African-American community. I think the African-American experience is a little bit different than the Latino, in that the Latino has been integrated into American politics in different ways for the last 150 years, and sort of each of those different periods and different waves of immigrants has led to different kinds of connections. So, for example, when Cuban Americans went into South Florida in the 1960s and 1970s, their opportunities were much greater in the Republican Party. There was basically no Republican Party in South Florida. So to the degree that they wanted to get ahead quickly, they saw, well, you know, there's an opportunity here. We might as well seize it. And in a sense, they've reshaped the Florida Republican Party. It doesn't look as strident, perhaps, as some of the other Southern Republican parties. Mexican Americans in the Southwest, on the other hand, were, you know, brought into regular participation in politics through the New Deal and then through the Great Society. And it was Democrats who were leading those efforts and were providing the sorts of resources and assistance and vision of government that Mexican Americans were concerned about. And they, as a result, became Democrats at pretty high rates, not as high as African Americans became Democrats, certainly. So, you know, as much as the Latino experience has become somewhat homogenized in the last decade or 15 years, perhaps, there were many years where there were very separate experiences going on throughout the United States.
Well, politics is all about agenda. It's all about turf. It's all about gaining turf, keeping turf. Within this multi-ethnic, non-monolithic Latino electorate, is there a group whose agenda items are dominating the conversation
Well, I think the Democrats generally speak more closely to the concerns of Latinos. If you look at public opinion polls, really going back now 20 years or so, Latinos put education at the top of the list. They put the economy at the top of the list. More recently, immigration has become a very important issue in Latino communities. And generally, Democratic leaders, whether Latino or non-Latino Democratic leaders, speak much more to those issues and to the understanding of Latinos about what should be done with those issues. So even in the Cuban American community, if you look at the second generation, the young adults who were born here in the United States and raised and educated in the United States, on a number of issues, they're arguably closer to sort of the modal point of the Democratic Party than they are to, many in the Republican Party today. Certainly for Cuban Americans, though, Cuba and Castro remain an issue across generations. So I think the Democrats have been much more successful at speaking to core Latino issues. I think the second way that Democrats have been more successful is that they're more likely to invest resources in turning Latino votes out. And I think that's a very important part of the story also. The Latino electorate is much more likely to be a new electorate, meaning folks who are either, recently turned 18 or in their 20s, or hitting maybe the first election where they're thinking about voting, or are recently naturalized U.S. citizens, of all ages. And for those new electorates, people who are not sort of routinized to participation, somebody has to go out and recruit them. We make voting very complicated in the United States, and if there isn't a resource to train people to vote, they're going to vote at lower levels. So the Democrats, recognizing that Latino votes are generally advantageous to their candidates, have spent more, particularly in the competitive states, in the battleground states, to turn out Latino votes. This is a great concern, though, because the majority of Latinos live in non-battleground states. The four states with the largest Latino populations are California, Texas, New York, and Illinois. Those four states alone account for over half of Latino adults. And there hasn't been a competitive election in any of those states in a number of years. As a result, there's been less investment in turning Latino votes out, and we're seeing a lag among Latinos in those states in terms of voting. So, long answer to your question, the Democrats both speak more to the issues of concern of Latino communities, but also recognize that their responsibility is mobilization, and they're, at least in battleground states, doing that pretty well.
You say that sheer numbers alone do not ensure that Latino communities will become central to the American political process. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have the institution of the Electoral College, which is an incredible barrier to growing majorities or growing populations in some of the states, like the Latino community. So, again, for example, looking at those four states where the largest numbers of Latinos reside, each is pretty solidly in one camp or the other. Three of them are solidly Democratic states, California, New York, and Illinois, and Texas is pretty solidly in the Republican camp. So there's no incentive in any of those states to turn out more Latino votes, or for that matter, more white votes or more black votes. As a result, the numbers of the Latino community, which are growing, and the number of adult citizens, people who can vote, is growing, but the incentive to turn out as many of them as humanly possible isn't there. Instead, the candidates, and particularly the Democrats in this cycle, are investing a lot in turning out Latinos in New Mexico, in Nevada, in Colorado, in Virginia. And each of those states are very, very important, but they don't add to, even if you were to hypothetically double the Latino vote in each of those states, it really wouldn't add that much to the national Latino turnout, because those big four states are so much bigger. So it's an impediment to a pure majoritarian democracy to have this sort of anti-democratic thing called the Electoral College. Imagine how different our electoral system would be if the goal were to get the most votes rather than the most electoral votes. We'd be seeing a lot of candidate visits to California, to New York, to Florida, where they are going anyway, to Texas, to turn out big numbers. And if your goal is to turn out big numbers, you'd look for concentrations. Well, Latinos tend to live in urban areas where they're where they're very concentrated. So that's one barrier to sort of Latino votes counting purely based on their numbers. The second is that we have a lot of electoral rules. You know, some of those we've had for a long time, such as voter registration. Some are being newly imposed, you know, photo ID requirements in a number of states. Each of those serve to push away electorates that are less connected to the electoral system. You know, people in Governor Romney's circle, I'm sure, you know, wouldn't have any problem whatever rules we came up with. But if you're a, you know, somebody who works full-time, doesn't necessarily have the exact form of ID that's needed, doesn't have a picture, doesn't have an address, you're afraid of the process anyway because you're not a regular voter, you know, you're less likely to turn out on election day. There was an estimate done by some colleagues up at California Institute of Technology that if California, for example, were to go to same-day voter registration, meaning allowing people who aren't registered to register on election day and vote a provisional ballot, and assuming their registration goes through, that that vote be counted, found that California Latino turnout would go up by about 10%. So that's just one rule change that would allow for a greater voice for Latino electorates, you know, and still protect the integrity of the voting system. Numbers are important, you know, undoubtedly, but we also have institutional barriers that prevent those numbers from counting equally across the country.
Well, no doubt this has always been a very important segment of the general electorate. Why is it that the Latino electorate this year has become so critical a factor in the outcome of the presidential election?
You know, I would say that it grows with each election cycle, meaning, you know, 2000 was more than 96 and 2004 more than 2000. I think the reason that we're hearing sort of a greater national rhetoric around the Latino vote is twofold. One is that it's a very, very close race. You know, going into August, you know, by the best polling estimates, 85 or 90% of the people had already, or the potential voters had already made up their mind. So there's a very, very small window of, you know, people who could be moved. Well, Latinos are in that category, not because they're not regular Democrats, but they can be moved from out of the electorate to into the electorate. You know, they have a big reserve pool of potential voters. If the right message is articulated, and I think President Obama has, you know, worked hard with his immigration message, and the right investment is made in A, getting them registered, and B, turning them out on election day. So the first part of the answer has to do with the fact that Latinos are a potentially movable electorate here, moving them into the electorate from non-voting. I think the second reason that we're hearing more and more about Latinos is that the Republican rhetoric in the primary was so anti-immigrant and so, you know, sort of vitriolic about the Latino experience. Republican leaders recognize that they run a big risk, and they maybe have, you know, one more chance to make up for it. They don't want the Latino electorate to become like the African American electorate and becoming reliably 80 or 90% Democrat. And it, you know, it's moving in that direction. It's not there yet, certainly. So, you know, I think Republican leaders and Governor Romney have been careful to perhaps reach out to Latinos more than they would have otherwise in terms of expecting their votes, just to hold on to that possibility that, you know, as the Republican Party becomes a little bit more inclusive in the future, it, you know, it can include some Latinos in its story. So, you know, Governor Romney last week, spoke to the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, you know, clearly a Latino organization, but one that probably tilts a little bit to the right on economic issues. He spoke on Spanish language television, as did President Obama. So, you know, he's dedicating some of his time, if not for his own election, you know, for the future of the Republican Party, to hold on to some share of the Latino electorate.
Well, clearly, I mean, the stakes are so high, and the prize is so coveted. Both political candidates would do just about anything to get the votes that they need to get into office. But is there evidence of equal enthusiasm about integrating Latinos within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party remain remarkably similar in this regard, that as much as they want the Latino vote, they don't necessarily want Latinos in the party itself. It seems as if the attitude is, vote for me and then, you know, just kind of get lost.
You know, I might respectfully disagree. I think, you know, if we look at sort of leaders of from either party who have been, you know, elected to senior offices or appointed to senior offices, the Democrats have a better track record. Certainly they have a long way to go. But, you know, if you think of, you know, Henry Cisneros coming out of San Antonio in the 1980s and going on to the Clinton cabinet, Federico Peña coming out of the mayoralty of Denver, you know, now Mayor Castro in San Antonio again. You know, Senator Salazar, now Secretary Salazar, you know, the Democrats have, though they haven't actively recruited people, I think, as the Republicans have, in a couple of cases recently, the pool of Democratic elected officials is much more diverse than the pool of Republican elected officials. I think the Democrats have also, in the recent presidential cycles, invested a lot more in voter outreach, again, in swing states, you know, neglecting the vast majority, but, you know, the states that can lead to their victory. And then if I look at, you know, the issues that President Obama has taken up in his first term, a number of them hit very close to the concerns of Latino communities. National health care, you know, the Affordable Care Act is hugely popular in Latino communities, you know, a population that has the highest rates of non-insurance in the country. Though it took him a while to get there, you know, his recent administrative actions to ensure that the Dreamers are able to stay in the United States initially for 2 years and work during that time, very popular in Latino communities. So, you know, if the question is, could Obama or the Democrats have done more, the answer is always yes. But, you know, certainly compared to what the Republicans have offered on those same sorts of issues, the, you know, Latino community sees allies in the Democratic Party.
If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Professor Louis DeCipio, the number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I want to ask about your tracking. You've been tracking election cycles since 1988. What do you see as the significance or the potential outcome in this particular presidential election cycle?
I think we see that more of the battleground states, and unfortunately that's where everybody's putting their energies, have significant, sizable enough Latino electorates that those electorates can ally with others, generally African Americans, but sometimes liberal whites, to ensure an Obama victory, you know, in states that didn't traditionally vote for Democrats. So here I'd look to Virginia, you know, which is not a state we think of as having a particularly sizable Latino community, but Northern Virginia has been the target, the destination of Latino migration for the last 20 years. It's been the destination also of a professional Latino migration, working for either national organizations or the U.S. government. And that electorate certainly isn't big enough in and of itself to ensure Democratic victory in the state, but when it allies with an energized African-American community that's supportive of President Obama, and then, again, a liberal white population in Northern Virginia, you see a state that traditionally was in the Republican camp, you know, is in the South, but seems a very likely Democratic pickup this time. There's a Senate race in that same state where that same alliance might, you know, elect a moderate Democrat over a very conservative Republican. So, you know, that's an example of sort of the newly emerging power of Latino electorates. In the three western battleground states, the Latino electorate is the core factor in an Obama victory. So here I'm talking about Nevada, New Mexico, and Colorado. Florida is the interesting case. Latinos can undoubtedly be influential there, but they can be influential in either way. They can be influential by turning out in larger numbers in South Florida, supporting Governor Romney and ensuring his victory in the state, or turning out in the sort of Orlando-Tampa I-4 corridor in large numbers and ensuring a President Obama's victory, which is what happened in 2008. So, you know, to tell a story about the Latino influence, you sort of have to be looking at, you know, the demographics of a handful of states and where the most rapidly growing electorate is the Latino electorate, and that's the one that, you know, that's the one that can turn out in larger numbers, and if it does, that probably means a Democratic victory. If it turns out in sort of traditional levels, it means a Republican victory in Florida. I think we're also seeing a couple of congressional races and Senate races where Latino electorates can be key. I mentioned the Virginia case. We have a competitive seat in New Mexico, an open seat. There again, if there's a large Latino turnout, it gives the Democrat the advantage. Nevada is sort of the same story with it's not an open seat, but it's a seat held by an appointed member of the Senate. So, you know, somebody who's never really faced the electorate statewide before. So in each of those cases, it's not Latinos operating alone, but it's Latinos building the Democratic vote and ensuring then that electorates that weren't previously able to be in the majority are able to be in the majority.
Well, you mentioned Florida, and I wanted to cite the report from the Center for American Progress that says that although Latinos would have a combined 12.1 million in eligible but unregistered Latino voters in Florida, that number is 1.4 million, the number of people who might be ineligible by virtue of voting these new voting laws and the purging of voter rolls, five times Obama's margin of victory in 2008. That's extraordinary.
It is. This is the sort of revenge of the Tea Party elected attorneys general. We're seeing it not just in Florida, but really in about half the states now. There's some form of either more stringent voter registration requirements or voter ID legislation. In some cases, the voter ID legislation doesn't take effect until after the 2012 election, and in a couple of cases, the courts have at least put it on hold for the time being. So I think what I'm saying is it'll be bad in 2012. I think we'll see the full effects in 2014 and 2016. Yeah, these laws are targeted at marginal electorates, you know, people that are not regular participants in the process who know how to, know how the process works and know how to challenge unfair or arbitrary decisions at the polling places. And I have a great concern that in Ohio, in Florida, that these laws, rather than the will of the people, might determine the outcome. Now, luckily, you know, we are seeing a lot of litigation around these issues, so, you know, I think the full effect will be delayed. But, you know, use the practical example for Latinos. If you're not a driver and you're a naturalized citizen, the piece of paper that you have to prove your voting eligibility is your naturalization certificate, which isn't a wallet-sized card. It's a certificate. I mean, it's something that people put on their walls with great pride. But it also says at the bottom, do not fold. So, you know, you can't easily bring it with you when you're going to a polling place. You can obviously take that to a driver's license bureau and get a driver's license, but if you don't drive, you can't do that. Costs money to get a driver's license. The advocates of these voter restriction laws say, well, you can get a passport. Well, a passport costs $100 and, again, takes some time. You know, so it's not like, you know, you can immediately go from being a part of this country, being a naturalized citizen, to being a full participant in this country. And that's a very disturbing step that disproportionately affects Latino communities. Second way in which Latinos are disadvantaged, I think, in this, and here Asian Americans are also, is that the effort to review voting lists for non-eligible voters, for people who are not citizens. In immigrant communities, you tend to have a greater homogeneity of names, in other words, similar names, and people that are purging the list don't have the eye to distinction. So, you know, people with a name similar to somebody who is not a U.S. citizen might get purged from the list and be notified of that, but it would be weeks before he or she could resolve that problem. And this is a huge problem in Asian American communities where there are often anglicized first names used instead of sort of legal first names. So these efforts to you know, purge voter registration lists and then to require photo IDs at the polls and evidence of citizenship in some cases, you know, are going to disproportionately affect Latino and Asian American communities.
Finally, Professor DeCipio, I wanted to ask about you, what you observe in the way of coalition politics. It seems that one of the things that I'm getting, and I don't know what your view is of it, is that there is, with this burgeoning Latino electorate, there's a decided character to coalition politics. And the sense of it is that it is not coalition politics anymore. It's more constituent politics. Do you sense that as well?
You know, I think the answer varies between national politics and local politics. At the local level, there are good examples of true coalitional politics, you know, where communities of shared interests but different, you know, whatever the distinguishing characteristic is, race, ethnicity, or immigration set, whatever, do get together and have ensured that, you know, that new voices are heard in the political process. So, you know, sort of Mayor Castro in San Antonio, who spoke at the Democratic Convention, would not have been elected were it not for a multiracial, multiethnic coalition. I think at the national level, and I think this speaks to the weakness of the leaders as well as some of the leaders of the community or ethnic organizations, tends to focus more on the unique benefits or the unique rewards that government can provide for groups, for individual groups. So we haven't really sort of instilled at the national level that sort of need to work together in the same way perhaps that we you know, have at the local level. And I might use the day that the DREAM Act failed in the United States Senate. It wasn't able to overcome cloture. That was also the day that the Senate, in a historic civil rights action, overruled Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But that same coalition that was able to support Don't Ask, Don't Tell wasn't able to hold together in order to support the DREAM Act. And, you know, that's reflective, I think, of an incomplete vision of civil rights.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Professor DeCipio, for joining us today and giving us this great overview. Certainly, we'll be calling on you again to take us deeper into politics 2012. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break and come back with a whole other story unfolding in New York City. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. The New York City Parents Union is gearing up for a legal battle with City Hall. The city's Department of Education has okayed the availability of the so-called morning after drug and other birth control drugs to girls as young as 14 without parental consent. Mona Davids is president of the Parents Union. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Davids.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. What is the basis for the legal action that the Parents Union is considering?
Well, for us, we're trying to deal with the absurdity of Mayor Bloomberg and the Department of Education and the Department of Health providing young girls between the ages of 14 and 17 a chemical hormonal drug cocktail without parents' permission, yet they can't even provide an aspirin to any child in the school system if they're not feeling well. So we want to know what gives Mayor Bloomberg the right to circumvent federal law as well as circumvent parent rights and give our children this drug that they have to ingest without knowing the prior medical history of the child, without knowing if the child has drug allergies. What gives him the right to do that? He has no right to do that. much less with his silly opt-out letter that they allege they've sent to parents.
What is this opt-out letter?
Well, the Department of Education and the Department of Health are saying that they sent a letter to the parents of all these young people in the high schools, giving them an option to opt out. In other words, if they don't want their child to receive condoms or morning after pill or Depo Provera or the regular birth control pills, they have to sign and say they want to opt their children out of, and then they have to check each service they want to opt their children out of and return it to the school. Now, when it comes to anything medical, and even when it comes to something as basic as going on a class trip, the New York City Department of Education does not do opt-out. There has to be informed consent. So parents have to sign and opt-in and give informed consent for anything, for any class trip, for anything that happens in the schools. So why is it for this parents have to opt out? Because we have no proof that letters were sent to parents, and now more and more parents are coming out and saying they never received any letters. We're just going by the hearsay of Mayor Bloomberg and the Department of Health and the Department of Education that we already know from our experience, including legally, have a record of not notifying parents on anything. We've won injunctions against them in the past because they fail to notify parents. They lie. So with this, for us, this is just the fourth issue or the fourth incident in the past year where they say they've notified parents, and which we know for a fact is a lie and not completely true.
Is a parents' union fundamentally against contraception, contraceptives available in public schools?
You know, we haven't taken a stand on it not being available in public schools because, you know, we represent parents, and different parents have different views. Religious parents tend to take the stand of, you know, absolutely not. More mainstream or liberal parents may feel a little bit differently. But the one thing that all of our parents agree on is that he has no right to give any child any kind of medication, much less a chemical, hormonal, drug cocktail, without telling the parents and without knowing the child's medical history and if the child has any drug allergies. No rights.
Well, this program became a point of contention, but what is unique so far, at least to my sense of it, is that it is not system-wide. It is at 13 public schools. What is it about these particular public schools that makes it okay to target this program at these 13 public schools?
Well, the 13 public schools that he has targeted are schools that are majority Black, Latino, and immigrant students. The schools he has targeted are high poverty schools with children of low income parents. Those are the schools that he has targeted. He has not targeted schools like my daughter's high school, that's a specialized high school. He has not targeted schools in in middle class or affluent neighborhoods. These schools are high poverty, Black and Latino and immigrant students that attend these schools.
So what do you read? What are you reading by that action, by targeting these schools?
To be honest with you, it's alarming to me as a parent. And one thing we've learned in New York City is that Mayor Bloomberg has a low disregard for parents in general.
I mean, you mean
and
a high disregard.
I'm sorry, a high disregard for parents in general, and most certainly parents of color, because he does not believe we know what's in the best interest of our children. And this clearly is, you know, something else that he's decided that black and Latino parents and low-income parents and immigrant parents, don't have the ability and the competence to know what's in the best interest of their children. He does.
Well, let me just ask you this question. There is would you deny that there is a concern about the incidence of unwanted pregnancies in high school?
No, absolutely. We're all concerned about this, but we are the largest school district, school system, not only in the nation, but in the world. We have 1.4 million children. Out of those 1.4 million children, at least about 600,000 of them are high school students. So we're talking, because they keep on throwing it out, 7,000 students in the entire city. That does not give him the right to circumvent federal law that says no child under the age of 17 without parent permission and a prescription from the doctor should be allowed to receive the morning after pill. And that's what he's doing, because he keeps on quoting in every statement that he makes, he keeps on quoting New York State education law that he says allows him to do it. But you know what? Federal law does not allow him to do it. And as recently as last December, he and the Health and Human Services Secretary, Mrs. Sebelius, were going back and forth because she overruled FDA and said that under no circumstances should the morning after pill be given to minors. And he publicly berated her for it. But he's found a way to circumvent what the federal government says about keeping our children safe. They do
but
not.
Your school's chancellor, Dennis Walcott, is African-American. He has a history of involvement in organizations like the Urban League and other civil rights organizations. Why is it that Bloomberg is the villain here? What's going on with your school's chancellor that he's not stepping up to the plate and living out the true meaning of his prior involvement in these civil rights organizations?
Well, it's interesting. People tend to forget that, one, the chancellor serves at the pleasure of the mayor. Two, Dennis Walcott was deputy mayor for education and community development for 10 years. Joe Klein reported to Dennis Walcott. This was all under mayoral control, where they pretty much destroyed our public school system. Our students, only one out of four high school graduates are college ready. We have increased segregation in our school system. The racial achievement gap has completely more than doubled. And most recently, as last week Thursday, the Wall Street Journal had a full front page article about the lack of parental involvement and engagement between parents and the Department of Education, and that it's reached an historic low. It's the lowest that it has ever been since they've been keeping data on it. So parents in New York City have a very low opinion of Dennis Walcott. Dennis Walcott, since he's been chancellor, has continued what Joe Klein has done, which is isolate, disrespect the parents here in New York City. We do not believe he is qualified to be chancellor. We sued Bloomberg over Kathy Black because she wasn't qualified, and neither is Dennis. And we are truly sick and tired of Bloomberg appointing non-educators with no background in education to lead the nation's largest school system. So when you ask me about Dennis Wolcott, and if you ask parents about Dennis Wolcott, we really don't have anything positive to say about him. To be honest with you, we just say he's just a puppet of Mayor Bloomberg's.
This issue of the birth control, the injectable Plan B emergency contraception, this fight, you said, is the latest in a string of issues that you've had. What you said about four of them. What were the others?
Well, let's see. We had Kathy Black.
Explain who she is.
Okay, Kathy Black is a former media executive, and she is a social friend of Mayor Bloomberg's. When Chancellor Klein resigned to go and head up the education division of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, out of the blue, Bloomberg appointed Kathy Black. No education experience whatsoever. She had never even stepped into a public school. He appointed her as chancellor, and because we have mayoral control of the schools, there was no search. There was no national search. She wasn't vetted. She was appointed. We sued in Supreme Court. We lost in Supreme Court. We appealed, but before our appeal became before the judge, less than 96 days into her tenure, Bloomberg fired her.
Okay, that's issue one. What's your next issue?
Issue one. Oh, and by the way, the biggest issue with Kathy Black, during a tenure that got the most attention, was when she went to a parent meeting. And when parents complained about the schools being overcrowded, Kathy Black responded with, "The parents need to go on birth control."
That's very insightful.
Yes. So that was one. So that was our first issue. Then our second issue was the Community Education Council elections. Under mayoral control, we do not have community school boards, but we have what is called advisory parent councils. Our state education law says that starting in January, the Department of Education must publicize to parents that there are upcoming elections so that parents can get involved in the schools and they can be involved civically. It says starting in January. State education law clearly lays out the process. The election was in May. The Department of Education didn't start informing parents about the elections until April. And then to make it matters even worse, they said that parents have to vote online. Majority of parents in New York City do not have internet access. The majority of parents in New York City are Black and Latino. The majority of parents in New York City are low-income parents. So what they essentially did was disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of parents. And when every elected official and community leader said, no, this is wrong, they refused to redo the election process and do it properly. And they said that, they notified parents through the mail that the elections were happening. We took them to court, and we won an injunction because guess what? They lied. Parents didn't receive the notices. So we have experience with the Department of Education doing this. The most recent thing is the Department of Education is always trying to cut school budgets, cut funding for the schools, and they are always targeting students with special needs, our special education children, our most high needs children. And as recent as last month, the Department of Education started to roll out a new special education initiative. They were supposed to notify parents of this over a year ago. We started making noise about it. We started saying parents don't know. They didn't notify parents. This initiative was going to start the first day of school, this school year. On the last day of school, the Department of Education sends out a letter to the principals at every school to notify parents about the new initiative. It was a half day at school. Parents never got the letter, but it's a letter that should have been sent almost a year ago. So when I say, when it comes to parent engagement and consulting parents this administration completely ignores the parents. And they've obviously decided that they know what is in the best interest of our children, that the medical history or drug allergies that a child may have is not important, and heaven forbid one day something happens to someone's child.
Well, we're wrapping up. Could you give us an idea of what your timeline is with regard to the legal action that you're considering, the union is considering?
Yeah, our attorneys are busy conducting research right now, and we plan on filing for an injunction by the end of the week.
Well, Ms. Davids, Mona Davids, president of the New York City Parents Union, you are a capable spokesperson for the union. Thank you so much for being
Thank
with us today
so
to give us this briefing.
Me.
Certainly, we will be following this, so we expect you back here soon after your injunction is filed and to bring us up to speed with a number of other issues. And certainly, because we've been following the struggle out in Chicago, there are so many parallels here, so we'll have a more detailed discussion. But thank you so much for being with me today.
Very much. Bye-bye.
And I want to thank you for listening and want you to encourage people to listen in as well at 1 o'clock Monday through Friday Eastern Standard Time. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Great show ahead for you tomorrow. Please do tune in and tell others to do so as well. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.